Dr. Paul, welcome to Against the Wind, Doctors in Science Under Fire. This show's slightly different. I'm being interviewed. I'm going to cover the topics of RSV, influenza, and COVID. What's going on? What do you need to know? And how can you be prepared for this upcoming winter where all three are hitting at once? Bernadette closes us out with a very interesting take on the mindset of those in public health. They minimize vaccine dangers, they promote vaccine efficacy, and they maximize disease risk, completely distorting the actual information that's out there. Enjoy the show. Dr. Paul, coming to you from the heart. I'm going to talk to you about gratitude today. And first and foremost, I am grateful for you. Your support means the world to me. I'm going to share a card I got from a patient recently that just exemplifies the importance of this to me. Dr. Thomas, I want you to know how much our family appreciates you. Thank you for caring deeply for the health and well-being of all the families who have been under your care. Thank you for being bold and for shining a light in this dark world. I am so sorry for the disappointment, pushback, hatred, and heartbreak that you've had to go through, but I praise God for how He is using you to stand up for truth. I can only imagine how hard in every way it is to do this. So my prayer for you is that you will remain in God's steadfast love, His love and promises that will never shake or crumble, no matter what enemy you are facing, that you will seek His wisdom and take pause to hear His voice. I pray that God will protect you and your family fiercely, give you courage to do what He is asking, and be filled with great joy. Thank you, Dr. Thomas. And they share their names. Whew, that touches me. And I have to tell you, this is one of probably hundreds, if not a thousand, such cards and letters and sentiments. And it's kept me going through these difficult times. And I am so grateful for all of you who support me. It gives me that steadfast, we're together, we're never giving up, because we are being called to do something magnificent that our world is calling us to do. So thank you. Welcome, folks, to Against the Wind. Dee Dee Hoover joins me in studio. What the heck are you doing here?
Well, I am here because I'm the one, as you know, that gets all the emails. And I have to tell everyone, first of all, this is our second time doing this, and you did a very good job the first time, Doc.
Well, I thought you did a good
very
job, too.
Very proud of you. Thank you. So we get a lot of support, and I wanted to say that. You have so much love and so much support coming in, and I know I holler from one office to the other to you about that support. We also get a lot of questions, and right now, there's a huge amount of questions about this triple pandemic that's going on right now, and that is RSV, flu, and COVID, a huge hit right now. So I just want to ask you some questions, and the first thing I want to talk about is RSV. So I would like you to explain what that is and tell me about, because we've been getting a ton of patients in, and I think we've had one in our clinic here even hospitalized this year. So I'd like for you to talk a little bit about RSV. People keep asking. Some of the questions about RSV are, you know, what do I need to look for? When do I need to see a doctor? And the main one as you're talking about it is, if they get a vaccine, should I run out and get this vaccine?
Thank you for that question. I'm gonna start with the last thing you mentioned. If they come up with an RSV vaccine, should you run out and get it? No. Here's why. They are trying to make an RSV vaccine on the mRNA platform. Folks, they've been trying to do this for two decades. And they've failed because of the nature of mRNA platform. It's just not been possible to make it work for viruses that mutate very quickly. That's why it failed for COVID. It will fail for RSV for the same reason. It has failed. They have this thing called immune enhancement that happens with that form of vaccination. And in the early trials they did for RSV, they would vaccinate the animals, right, in the animal trials, be it rats or ferrets or whatever, and it would look like the vaccine was okay, safety-wise, and then when those animals were re-exposed with RSV, a large percentage, in some trials, all of them, died. And it's a complicated topic that I've covered on another show. Dr. Ryan Cole covers it very nicely, so check that out to review it. But this is not a virus that is going to be immune. You can't make a vaccine on an mRNA platform for an RSV, at least not at this time. The technology is not ready. It got rushed for COVID. They're trying to rush it again for RSV. Don't let your kid, or actually they're trying to do this for pregnant women. There's nothing worse than thinking about causing immune activation during pregnancy. We have studies showing that any kind of infection, viral infections in particular during pregnancy, can cause problems with brain development. Why on this good green earth would you intentionally activate the immune system while you're pregnant? It makes zero sense. So that was the long answer, which was the short answer was no, but I wanted to explain there's some real science behind why it's not a good idea.
No, thank you for answering that. But back to explain RSV first of all, simply, so that people understand that don't know what it is.
Yeah, respiratory syncytial virus is what it stands for, is basically a cold. Okay. It's a virus that causes cold-like symptoms, but it's a specifically mucogenic, which just means it makes you all mucousy, more so than I think other colds. And if you think about the size of airways, adults and large children have a big trachea, big bronchioles, even their littler tubes are big enough that if they get a little mucousy, they can handle it. But if a little baby gets RSV, especially the preemies, they're the ones that have a terrible time because there's enough mucus to actually block airways. And so their oxygenation can dip significantly and potentially be dangerous. I don't want you to be scared of RSV, folks. I mean, if you have an extreme preemie or a preemie or newborn with significant heart or lung issues, yeah, stay away from anybody that's sick. You know, it may not just be RSV, but influenza, COVID, the whole list. And there's a long list of viruses, some bacteria that can cause lung infections. You don't want any of that if you are that vulnerable. And that's where you'll get a number of deaths every year from RSV, and it almost always ends up being people who have underlying high risk, those extreme preemies, people with heart lung problems. But yeah, RSV, I've known this since I was a pediatrician 35 years ago. Every winter we see RSV. And rarely does anybody end up in the hospital. And really, you go to the hospital for one of two reasons. Either you can't drink anymore, you're so congested, you go to nurse or take a bottle and your nose is plugged, it's congested. Now you plug the mouth, they can't breathe. So they're just shoving, gasping for air. So you go for IV hydration, or you go because you need oxygen. And actually, I had this great family in my practice from Italy, and they said, no respectful Italian, I wish I could have done it in her accent, leaves home without a pulse oximeter. This is the most important little tool you should all have at home. It works like this.
Say it again, what is it?
It's a pulse oximeter. Okay. It measures the oxygen in your blood. Just reads the oxygen in your blood. It can be hard to use on a newborn or a tiny infant, but you just push the start button, stick your finger in there on the red flashing light, and hold still. And it starts to count the heartbeat. Boom, 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 boom. You have a 97 heartbeat. No, 90. No, 84. Well, you're relaxing. You were a little tense here to begin with.
Yes, I was.
But your oxygen's 96, and that's not bad. Normal is 97 to 100. I always knew you weren't normal.
Well, and I mean, it's...
You have asthma. I know that.
Well, and it's not just that. We're talking about RSV and everything. One of my questions is, you talked about it in children, but... I know with us being so exposed, you were sick last week, and I was, is RSV something that affects adults? Because I know everything you've been describing, I've been feeling, and I know you've felt. So
yes, RSV will affect adults, but generally it's just a cold.
Okay.
It could be a bad cold, and RSV tends to last a little longer than most colds. Your typical viral illness, be it a cold or whatever, the flu, lasts for 7 to 10 days. RSV peaks around day 4 to 7 and lasts for 2 to 4 weeks. And so I can't tell you how many patients I saw just this week who their kids have been sick for 10, 12 days, a couple of them 2, 3 weeks, and they're like frustrated to go do something. Well, that might just be the normal course of RSV, or it could be. You are absolutely right. We are seeing more RSV, more COVID, and definitely more influenza A and B. Actually, all A so far in my practice. In the last... You're interviewing me, the day before I end my clinical practice in Oregon. So I can speak as a clinician right now. Mm-hmm. We're just doing this interview a little early before we take a trip to speak. But what I've been seeing in the clinic for the last 2-3 weeks, a huge number of positives for influenza A, still getting positive COVID tests, and plenty of RSV positives. It is actually happening, as they're saying on the news. I don't think it's nearly as scary as they make it out to be. Our news loves to be dramatic. Mm-hmm. It sells. But I'm not trying to minimize the fact that RSV in a preemie or in a very young infant who has heart conditions, you don't want that, but you don't need to be afraid of it. If you get adequate volumes of nutrition, so if you're a mama at home breastfeeding, for example, you feed as much as you can. You tank that baby up as much as you possibly can, because that'll keep them out of the hospital, right? Because they're hydrated enough, they're having enough wet diapers. Also, being able to get enough oxygen. So that you don't have as much control over, but you can certainly test it. I showed you the pulse ox. That's something you can get on, you know, any pharmacy or online stores and have it at home to use, so you know when you need to go to the hospital. If your baby is having a pulse ox close to 90, say 91, 92 or less, you should go be seen. If your doctor's office handles those sorts of things as ours does, go see your doctor. But oftentimes they don't. You have to go to the hospital and just, it may be that you need oxygen.
Okay. So with all of those things, it's November. Did you know that?
It's almost the end of November.
Yeah. So I don't remember seeing everything like this soon. Can you speak to that? Because I know you had made a comment that normally it's December or January. I think one time you said, oh, peak is January.
Right.
It's November.
And in fact, it felt like we were peaking in early to mid-November. And in some parts of the country, that's what happened. I saw a recent chart, I believe it was from the CDC, that went over the last many years of RSV, influenza, and of course COVID. And what they showed was back in, up until 2019, we had a winter peak that was around December, January of RSV, influenza, and then it goes down by April or May, it's gone. Every year you had that same peak. 2021, no RSV, no influenza, like none. What? Where did it go?
We weren't seeing anything.
We weren't seeing anything. People weren't going to the hospital. They weren't going to their doctor's office. We were on lockdown for COVID, and the only testing that was being done for the most part was for COVID. And I remember we kept our office open the whole time, and I remember thinking, what the heck? Have they forgotten that there's a list of about 30 things that can cause fever, headaches, body aches, cough? But no, it was just COVID or otherwise. But they were tracking the data as we started opening up, and you see this steady rise in RSV and influenza, not the spikes. Mm-hmm. Like 2021, that winter, not the one we're entering, but the one before, it was just a slow, steady rise, no peak. And I think that's just as we saw more and more kids, and kids were allowed to be together in schools, you start sharing these germs. But it's been a very abnormal sort of pattern. And I think it's just a function of, one, the quarantine, and two, when you haven't been sick for 2-3 years and you haven't been mingling, you have 2-3 years of babies being born, for one thing, whose immune systems have not been exercised at all.
Right.
So there is, I mean, we used to see this with measles before the, measles and chickenpox before the vaccines were introduced, especially measles. Every 2-3 years would be a big old outbreak. And that's 2-3 years worth of newborns who are up to now 2 or 3 years old who've never had measles, goes through the community. Now the immunity's good, and nothing for another 2-3 years. So we have those seasonal spikes. I don't know if that helps at all, but it's definitely different.
It does. So that brings us to your child gets RSV. You've told us what to look for. So let's talk fever, though, because that seems to be a big one. We'll even get emails on, you know, what fever, and I always wonder, I may not see the email for 1 or 2 days, and I'm like, oh gosh, your child has, why are you sending an email?
Right.
So talk about fever.
Okay.
And in children in general, but even especially like right now, RSV is affecting a lot of babies in our clinic, and people don't know when to go to the hospital.
Yeah. You go to the hospital if you need fluids or oxygen.
Right.
Or if you're close to needing it and you're unsure. If you have a good clinic where you can go to and they can assess oxygen, they can assess hydration, go to your regular doctor before you end up at the ER. The ERs are slammed with the sickest kids. Fever, on the other hand, thank you for bringing that to our attention. Fever is your friend. Fever.
What?
Yep. Fever helps your body knock out the virus. We've been taught to be afraid of fever, and it's the wrong teaching.
So, right, but do you think part of that fear comes because we hear, I mean, as a mom, when my son was younger, I heard that if your child gets I think I heard 104, 105 fever, that fever can kill them. I heard that.
Yeah, no, not at 104 or 5. I think if you get to 106, 7, you're in trouble. That's
even a thing?
I have not seen it, honestly.
Okay.
So
let's talk about that 103 to 105 fever that we're seeing right now.
Yeah. At 104 to 5, your child will probably be delirious.
Okay.
And they're so out of it that you don't know if they've got meningitis, which is super rare, by the way, or they've got a serious infection, right? That's making them just, not even be able to be responsive. So when it's that high and they're delirious or not responding well, you have to get it down as a diagnostic tool to see whether or not are they just delirious because they have a really high fever. If that's all, then they're okay. So there's a really cool way of getting the fever down. Ha, cool is a good
thought. Oh, no pun intended.
No pun intended. Well, you get a wet rag or washcloth and you get it fairly damp. I mean, not dripping wet, but but really moist. It could be slightly warm because cold will shock the child, and you just pat all over their body and let that water evaporate. And it's called latent heat of evaporation. It just brings the fever down. And you can bring a fever down in 5 to 10 minutes, like from 104 to 101, like
any that. Age that works?
Probably. I haven't tried it on adults.
Okay.
They probably would like punch me in the face.
Probably.
But it's
and
usually
just with an older child, like.
I mean, you've got more body surface area the older they are.
Okay.
Although.
Can you put them in a bath? Because I've heard you can put a child in like
a cooler
bath.
Yeah, it could be a lukewarm to coolish bath. That would probably do the same thing. But I think allowing that evaporation is what really works well.
Okay.
Also, the counter to that is if mom has a fever and she's breastfeeding and she's got skin to skin with their baby, but she's hot, baby can get hot.
Right.
And we've had that happen. Their baby feels hot. They forget that they're a bit warm too.
Right.
And they take the baby's temp, and if they're less than 6 to 8 weeks old and they have over 101.4, you got to go to the hospital. So it's like you just create a situation. You get there and they take the temp. It's normal. Well, it was up because of skin to skin. That happens right after birth too, right? If mom gets a fever from the work of labor, you can get pretty warm. Baby's born with a fever, but within an hour or two, it's normal. I digressed. What were we talking about?
Yes, we were just talking about
fever.
Fevers.
Don't be afraid of it, folks. Also, you can get it down with, like I said, the pat dry. I am not a fan of acetaminophen. That's the brand name is Tylenol. What Tylenol acetaminophen does is it blocks your N-acetylcysteine, NAC. And N-acetylcysteine is the precursor, it blocks glutathione. Glutathione is your major molecule for not only fighting the infection as a major antioxidant, but also for detoxifying. So when you block that pathway from N-acetylcysteine, NAC to glutathione with the acetaminophen, you're actually making your child or your patient more at risk for the infection, which that makes no sense, right? So if it's safe to use ibuprofen, if you have to use anything, you would use that. It's not supposed to be used under 6 months of age, but if you got under 6 months of age, just do the PAT thing anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna have you, because you said it quite quickly and I think it's really important. Please explain again why Tylenol is dangerous to give your child to bring a fever down.
So Tylenol, which is acetaminophen, has a very narrow therapeutic window. And what that means is you need this much for it to work, but if you have this much, it's toxic.
Right.
So it's very easy to get toxic. If you happen to be dehydrated, you can be toxic at these normal doses. And what are you when you're sick? You tend to be dehydrated. So it's really not a good thing to be giving at all. Probably shouldn't be over the counter. I think if they tried to bring that to market today, it would not make it. It would have to be a prescription drug because of that risky nature of that narrow window, therapeutic window. In your body, we have all these metabolic pathways. Every cell can make glutathione, which is a major antioxidant.
Okay, major antioxidant. And that's something your body needs.
Your body needs that to fight infection.
Okay.
You've heard of vitamin C being helpful, especially when you're sick. Mm-hmm. That's an antioxidant. And okay. glutathione and vitamin C are kind of working together. So okay. if you miss one of them, it really does affect your ability to fight infection.
So if those two things are helping fight infection, and you give something like acetaminophen, and it blocks that,
right.
then that's why it's not necessarily helpful. And again, if it reaches
Could
a toxic
harmful.
Level. Right. I just wanted to go through that slowly because that's another question that I get asked constantly. Well, I've heard Dr. Paul say, you know, not to do acetaminophen but yet every other doctor says give your baby Tylenol to bring down a fever. So
the first thing they say, it makes no sense.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think if you have acetaminophen in your house, throw it away. Not in the landfills. That's so hard. What do you do with all these pharmaceuticals that you don't need?
We
don't want to put them in the rivers and streams. I don't know if you want to bury them because then they're going to end up there. It's a conundrum. There are places to dispense of meds safely.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So these kids have colds, viruses, no matter what it is, and they're sick. When a child, and this is something that when I was responding back with somebody through emails and explained, again, not giving any advice or anything, but explaining why you would say not to use acetaminophen. They said what's difficult is the ibuprofen doesn't work as quickly, and then the child will be kind of, you know, doesn't look like they feel good, or they'll be lethargic kind of because of the fever. Isn't that okay? I think as parents, we get concerned, I don't want my child to look sick, I don't want my child to be sick, but isn't the point is the ibuprofen will help that fever from becoming dangerous, but the body needs to fight the infection in order to get rid of it?
So this goes back to fever is your friend.
Okay.
We're not anti-fever. So,
okay.
you know, as long as it's below 104, let's just use that as our cutoff, which is 40 degrees centigrade, 104 Fahrenheit, and your child is not lethargic and out of it.
Okay.
Right? If they're lethargic and out of it, you need to get that fever down
right.
to make sure they're in there, that they're okay.
Right. That's when they give Tylenol. Or, I'm sorry, acetaminophen. That's when parents feel like they need to.
Because they can't get it down.
Right.
Sponge them down.
Okay. And I think that's what I'm trying to say, is I think that when the normal that we hear from our pediatrician and most pediatrician is you don't want your child to, you know, you don't want them to look sick or be sick or feel sick or become lethargic. So to get that fever down, you give them Tylenol and they feel better. I see that all the time with my friends, even with their kids. So I guess that's coming back to you. That's the whole point, is there's other ways to do that with the cold.
Wet cloth, let the water evaporate. You can probably get it down in 5-10 minutes or for as long as necessary until the ibuprofen kicks in if you're needing to get it down. But here's the key. I don't want people to miss in all this. We've been talking a lot about it. If you can get it down and your kid looks fine, you can let it go back up.
Right.
You already know they're fine.
Okay.
Maybe twice a day you bring it down enough to be sure they're still fine.
Okay.
Right? Parent trick. If you've raised kids and you got to go to work the next day, you need your sleep. I would always dose with a dose of ibuprofen before I went to bed. I'm very selfish that way because it lasts for 6 to 8 hours. And that's all I need for sleep is 6 or 7 hours. So I got my sleep. I'm functioning the next day. My kids slept better because they didn't have high fevers in the middle of the night. The trick you should not do that I'm guilty of was sometimes ibuprofen out the door so they don't get a fever at school.
Oh my God.
Because then
and
they call
now
you.
We know why there's so much infection going around. Now, so let's bring it back to influenza and COVID and all these things. Can your child get all three? That was another question.
Of course, theoretically.
At the same time.
Theoretically, you could.
Mm-hmm.
I have not ever seen that.
Okay.
So when I used to do those recipe paths and they were testing for about 30 different organisms, mm-hmm. which included a coronavirus and influenza A and B and RSV, mycoplasma, rhinovirus, enteroviruses, you name it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you would get two or three.
Right.
But it was usually, remember, you're swabbing the nose. Now, there's a lot of stuff going on in there.
Mm-hmm.
Not all of it is actually causing you problems.
Oh, gotcha.
You are colonized also with various organisms that are just living at peace in your little cesspool of your nose. So the fact that you grew more than one thing shouldn't be alarming.
Okay.
Generally, it would be just one or two, though.
Okay.
And we know which things are more problematic. You're sicker with influenza, you're sicker with RSV. Early on, COVID for high-risk people was a concern. Okay. It's so interesting. Of the big three, because I've been testing all three for the last few weeks in my clinic, the one I'm worried the least about is COVID. When parents get a COVID, that he was the least sick with COVID of all of these. Yeah. Sicker with influenza A, sicker with RSV, sicker with some things that aren't any of those three.
Right.
So that fear of COVID can just go away. We don't need your COVID help anymore. We never needed it to begin with.
And with that, you're referring to the vaccine, because Correct. There are protocols and there are things to deal with it. And what I've noticed in the clinic that I'd like you to address, and one of the people who emailed had actually just shared that they appreciated you saying that you didn't feel like this COVID shot for children would be helpful, that especially those that got it in the last 6 months, the younger ones, that those kids, it could affect their immune system. A lot of the kids that we're seeing, and a lot of my friends' kids that got the shot, they're really struggling these seasons with all of these other issues with influenza. One child was very, very sick with influenza, and they had the shot. Do you think that that's part of it? Is the kids, even the older ones who are getting sick now that maybe wouldn't have because they had the vaccine, do you think that has to do with the immune system?
Absolutely. And I've had several guests speak to this. The vaccines in general, but the COVID jab in particular, really does a number on shifting your immune system into the make antibodies side of the immune system. So away from your innate, inborn T-cell immunity, if you will, and shifts it to B-cell, we're gonna make antibodies. You've gotta remember, antibodies are the second line defense. They're the backup. If an infection gets through and you become infected, it's only then that you make antibodies. And so shifting to making antibodies actually does some harm, because now if you get re-exposed to that disease and it enters because your innate immune system, your T-cell immunity is not working as well, which is what these shots are doing, you get a massive response. And this is this massive inflammation where I think we're seeing the myocarditis, the clotting problems, the adult death syndrome, people just dropping dead. It's a massive release of cytokines, inflammatory and what have you. Your immune system's on fire and it's not natural. So the advice at this point for COVID jabs for sure going forward, no way. No child should get them, and most of the really well-informed doctors who are dealing with this are saying nobody, period.
Okay. Well, thank you for answering questions. Again, most of them right now. And on the last one, we talked about polio. I think when so many things are going around, and you always talk so openly and freely about these things, it's very helpful and very supportive. But I do think that it is a real fear for parents, and especially moms. We seem to be like, we don't want our kids to be sick. And when you listen to the news and you see children outside of hospitals in these beds because they're at capacity and all these things that are happening, that's a real fear.
Yeah.
So just a final note, what can you say to parents? For me, it's faith over fear. You just have to have faith over fear. What is it as a doctor?
So I agree with faith over fear, but here's the great news. There are a whole host of things you can do. One, to prevent even getting these infections. Number one on that list is vitamin D, okay? If they had just given a care package to every citizen in the USA for enough vitamin D3 with K2, maybe add a little magnesium and zinc to that, we wouldn't have had an outbreak or epidemic at all. I'm pretty sure of that. So make sure your vitamin D status is optimal, not just normal, but optimal. And every good doctor I've talked to agrees with me, that's 50 to 80 micrograms per milliliter. And that's the normal in the US measurement.
Not prescribing or diagnosing.
No. Right, this is just informational, run it by your clinicians. You can go to the FLCCC, the Frontline Critical Care Alliance docs, and actually Dr. Paul Alexander's Substack recently put out a really
comprehensive document about what you can do. They have the eye prevent protocol. I mean, it's like use mouthwash, you can use a nose spray, you can use Pipovidine iodine spray. Just make it dilute enough so it's see-through brown and flush your nose twice a day. Whatever gets in there, whether it's COVID, flu, RSV, it's not getting past there. You're gonna knock it out, kill it on the spot before it enters your body. He talks about vitamin D, zinc, 20 to 50 micrograms per deciliter, vitamin C, 500 twice a day if you're an adult. You can go lower if you're younger. I mean, you can go way more if you can tolerate it. If you're older, melatonin, it actually is an antioxidant. It helps reduce binding to the ACE receptors. Interestingly enough, this same protocol that's been so successful with COVID actually works for RSV. Those two viruses actually have a lot of similarities. Elderberry, you've heard of it before. I would add elderberry just when you're sick. It's not something you need to take all the time. Same with resveratrol and quercetin. These help the zinc ionophores, it allows your immune system to be so much more robust. And believe it or not, ivermectin at that 0.2 milligrams per kilogram a couple times a week will prevent infection from RSV, COVID, probably influenza as well. N-acetylcysteine we talked about, and then the last and hardest to get in the USA in the winter is sunlight. I hope you will do a lot of these things, be prepared, and you don't need to be fearful. You can have incredible faith when you've also done your homework and you've prepared.
So, keep sending in your questions. Every once in a while, we'll have these little chats so that we can answer some of those questions for you. And I don't know if it's okay to say this or not, but upcoming, because you've got one more shift as a medical doctor here in Oregon, you're going to be doing some wellness coaching to help with a lot of people who want to connect with you personally and be able to really hear about how to advocate for yourself and your own health and your own wellness. So stay tuned.
It's Kids First Forever. This is my partner in crime right here, Didi Hoover. So folks, we're starting something special, Didi and I. It's called Kids First Forever. You can go to kidsfirstforever.com. That website's gonna be developing, and we will bring everything we possibly can to the world at that site. Looking forward to connecting with you and sharing this journey with you.
And it's Kids First Forever, the number 4, ever.com. And you can go and sign up now to be receiving our newsletters. When we start getting everything together and organized, we'll be sending out newsletters to let you know how to connect with us.
The 4 in Kids First Forever stands for?
Spiritual, emotional, physical, and mental, because all 4 of those areas are important.
There you have it, folks. See you next time. Welcome back to Against the Wind, Bernadette. It's always great to have you. I understand today you're going to talk to us about the mindset of people in public health. I'm eager to hear what you've got to say.
Yeah, thank you. Well, you know, it's so important when we're on this mission to really understand what we're up against, because, you know, while there's some demons out there as far as who know bad products and bad policy, the majority, literally hundreds of thousands of individuals working in public health have good hearts and they mean well. But the particular mindset has been directly influenced by, really, to use their term, misinformation. So I wanted to share with you this paper that was published in The Lancet. It is an opinion piece, but it really gives insight into the mindset of people in public health. They want to control communicable infections, contagious disease. And so in this was published in April of 2022 in The Lancet, Vaccination and Natural Immunity, Advantages and Risks as a Matter of Public Health Policy. So you'll see here, they looked at both and they say, although both methods, natural immunity and vaccination, provide some level of immunization, they create substantially different concerns for policy and substantially different risks for the individual, as natural immunity requires becoming infected. Their contrast should consider medical science, including the relative protection offered by each pathway. However, the larger debate must also address practical and logistical issues when applying immunization requirements through public policy. So, you know, you and I as individuals making our own health decisions, we're thinking about what's best for me. What's my individual risk? Can I overcome the disease? Will I develop natural immunity? How long does it last? That's how we base our decision for ourselves and our families. Public health has to take this larger view of what can we control? What can we put in policy that we can fund and that we can control?
Right. And I think you brought up in the beginning a very important point. And this is true for how most doctors think as well. Most MDs, we're trained that vaccines are safe. And so we don't look at side effects, and we're trained that they're effective. When in fact, certainly with the SARS-CoV-2 as a great illustration, the effectiveness is horrendous.
Yes, exactly. It quickly goes to negative efficacy, which makes right. It absolutely not just useless, but dangerous. So it's highlighted in the next thing I've got highlighted there. It says, foremost, the scientific evidence must be considered. Specific to SARS-CoV-2, some results suggest that vaccine-induced immunity is more effective. Other results suggest that natural immunity is more effective. So it's good they're reading all the studies out there. Some findings estimate both as roughly equal. But then we get down to risk exposure is the first issue for public health to consider. Notably, each pathway to immunity exposes individuals to different levels of risk. People could have adverse reactions to vaccines or severe outcomes due to infection. Well, that's absolutely agreed, right? This is common sense discussion. But then we get to this sentence, adverse effects have been minimal for COVID-19 vaccines. How in the world, unless they are living, which they apparently are, in this bubble that considers everything published at VAERS, all of the science showing the dangers of the lipid nanoparticles, mRNA-generated spike, you know, everything that we're seeing, how blind are they to that?
It's astounding. I mean, we know the increased huge signal in myocarditis, a whole new syndrome, adult sudden death syndrome. I mean, you've seen athletes dropping dead on the soccer fields. And these are not isolated cases. The literature is full of the horrendous amount of side effects from this jab.
Yes. And this segment is Be the News, right? I'm trying to empower people. This shows that there is, you know, as much as we are censored, the people who are being blocked most from the information we know are people in public health. So we must continue, you know, educating public health. Eventually, somebody will wake up and listen to what we're saying. So let's continue that. And then they go on to say that the SARS-CoV-2 exposure, meanwhile, carries significant and well-documented dangers. Well, that is somewhat true, but also misleading. And because SARS-CoV-2 holds dangers if you don't have adequate levels of vitamin D and zinc and glutathione, and if you don't have early treatment protocols at the ready to prevent severe disease. And these are things that public health is not even mentioning. They're not dealing with. That is another avenue that must be opened up into public health. And then they talk about reliability. How do you build policy around people getting sick? You don't know if they get sick. You don't know if they get re-exposed. And so they feel completely out of control. And I love the sentence here. Vaccination uses the same formula each time, the same dosage, and with an identifiable date of vaccination, waning immunity can be documented with high reliability. Natural immunity is highly variable by comparison. And public health people who are trying to set policy, they don't like variability. They don't like individuality. They want one size fits all approach. Whether it works or not.
I'm smiling because, okay, we've got data that the vaccine is not giving lasting protection. And while natural immunity, sure, it's variable, but it's giving very long lasting protection. Yes. Who cares if it's 1 year or 30 years? That's a whole lot better than 3 to 5 months. That's all you get with the COVID jab.
Yeah, if you get any at all,
and if at all,
it goes to negative and the risks. I mean, the thing is, you know what it is. It's just, it's absurd. But you know, I sense the earnestness in these individuals because they're having conversations that need to be public. I would love to have people on stage having this dialogue and then presenting the science on each side, because right. this is really important. And then sustainment is the third. And again, boosters for natural infections are more difficult to coordinate. Well, especially if the booster is natural exposure, right? Which is right. how colds and flus, generally you build immunity. You only typically get, if you're not being exposed to vaccine products, the flu like maybe every decade or 20 years, because every exposure then makes you more resilient for many years forward. And then it changes enough that yeah. then you know, you might get symptomatic disease after a certain point, but you can't control natural boosters. But you can control when you're going to give those boosters to the public if you've got a program. And so that's the mindset, the control, the paternalistic control. You know, how, so Dr. Paul, how do we help public health let go of their fear of not being in control? They right. only have this fear over vaccine targeted infections. You don't hear the panic and lack of control over the common cold.
Yeah, or the hundreds or thousands of infections that we don't have a vaccine for. There's right. no concern for those. I would say, as I listen to you presenting this, and it rings true, this is how doctors and public health officials think. And in fact, government officials who are helping set policy that they shouldn't be involved with. But anyway, they don't understand natural immunity. They don't understand the data. So it seems to me, and you're more involved with going to legislatures and, you know, trying to give people good information. But it seems like the only way forward is to present good information. So where can people go to get that good information?
Yeah, well, we need good information. We need to continue to educate the legislators in public health, but it's going to come from the individuals. When enough of the population knows the truth about each individual vaccine product, real health, early treatment, sustaining health, all of that, then there's going to be all this non-compliance with policy, right? So all of these educational avenues have to come forward. And where do you get good information? Well, you get it from Dr. Paul. You get it from Children's Health Defense, who That's links great. You to good science and good doctors. You get it from the FLCCC, the Frontline Critical Care, COVID-19 Critical Care Specialists. They're going to have to change their name eventually and take COVID out of there, because they're branching into flu and RSV now. It's wonderful right. Right. what they're doing to help people understand how you can protect yourself from severe disease from other infections.
Yeah. Yeah.
You go to your trusted healthcare provider, somebody who's aligned with you and understanding how brilliant your God-given immune system is to yep. Protecting you.
And I would add, when we say trusted healthcare provider, we are really talking about, as you said, someone aligned with your beliefs. But let's say you're watching this and you're not sure where you stand on vaccines. You at least want a doctor who's willing to let you be in charge. You're allowed to be the decision maker about what happens as you get informed. Mm-hmm. Because too many doctors are just, you do it my way or out the door.
Yes.
That's paternalism. That was gone back when I was in medical school. They were saying that's the worst kind of medicine. And yet that's what we're going back to, at least when you're talking about vaccines and pharma products.
Well, yeah, we're going back to that, but it's less an attitude that kind of came of the profession and the white coat and I can do this kind of thing. It's worse than that, because it's coming top down, where major entities are telling doctors what they can and cannot do or say. We've got that law in California silencing doctors. We've got it starts with an F, the Federation of Medical Boards, that is telling nurses, doctors, all practitioners what they can and cannot say and do.
Yeah, they sent out that letter last year to all the boards, basically stating that if doctors are not following the approved narrative, they are participating in disinformation and you should consider taking their license. So it's incredible pressure on doctors. If you're trying to support your family and you don't know anything else. I mean, I remember when I was first realizing I could lose my license, which of course now I have, thinking, wow, how would I support my family? And when I was younger, it was a real factor in me staying a little silent about what I knew. I shared the truth with my patients, but I wasn't out there on blast trying to tell the world because of the consequences. At this point, I don't care about the consequences. So let's go and let's let the world know what's really going on. Listen to people who have nothing to lose.
Listen to people. Exactly right. And two things should give you hope. Well, one is more and more people are joining you, Dr. Paul, and we really are at that point of medical history, of health history, where everybody who has something to risk and is being threatened needs to stand up. Because if everybody rises together, then you all will be heard. They can't silence you all, and we can take this back. So that's really important. And there is a growing parallel health system being developed. Dr. Pierre Corey's got an online medical service now. There's the Wellness Company. Dr. Peter McCullough and others have founded this. And there's multiple numbers. We should do an episode sometime in gathering more and more. And, you know, at first it's going to be difficult because, you know, they're not, a lot of these places aren't taking insurance and it's going to be an out-of-pocket expense. And eventually we have to find a way that, you know, anybody can go to them, even, you know, not being cost prohibitive. But in the meantime, if you can afford it, support these parallel medical systems that are going forward that represent.
And we will need parallel insurance products that will cover the alternative, the parallel system. And we're working on this, folks. If you are a healthcare professional and you're feeling you're in this bind of I'm going to lose my career or destroy my career, but you know what you need to be doing, I would just urge you to do what you need to do anyway. Because if you don't, think about the magnitude of stress, internal, it's just, if you're living from your soul at all, if you're connected at all to spirit, you can't do it. I mean, so you have to disconnect, and where does that take you? So grab hold of the truth, grab hold of the knowledge that you already have, and don't be shy. Be bold, stick to the truth, because it wins in the end. And we're real close, folks. The house of cards is going to fall apart, and it's coming quickly.
Yeah. You made me pretty emotional with that, Dr. Paul. Amen. I hope everybody's listening and takes heed. Thank you.
Thank you, Bernadette.
Dr. Paul, thanks for watching the show. Please visit doctorsandscience.com. There you can access our members-only section. This show is member-supported. We don't have to take sponsors. We don't have to have anybody controlling the content of our show. This is a huge perk most people aren't aware of. Your membership gives you access to my ebooks, transcripts of every show, PowerPoints from talks I'm giving around the country, and live bonus peeks at behind-the-scenes work we're doing, my off-the-cuff thoughts and reviews on current events. Your support makes all this possible. Thank you.
Help me spread the truth and share this on social media and with your friends at doctorsandscience.com. I look forward to running with you against the wind. Go to our website, doctorsandscience.com, sign up, donate if you can, and let's make this the weekly show the nation's been waiting for. I'm Dr. Paul.